This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Bill Hoagland, Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Bill Hoagland next. America's 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers count on a strong U.S. sugar policy to keep American consumers supplied with an essential ingredient. Better yet, it's designed to cost taxpayers nothing. These farmers support more than 151,000 jobs throughout the sugar supply chain in both urban and rural communities. They contribute over $23 billion to the economy each year and help keep it sweet in America. Learn how the Farm Bill supports sugar crop farmers and workers at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. 15 years ago, a group of congressional leaders named Dole, Baker, Mitchell, and Daschle helped to bring about a group dedicated to bring bipartisan solutions to critical policy decisions facing the nation. Bill Hoagland is Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says compromise is essential to democracy, and it isn't easy to achieve.
And I'm not a political scientist. So I'll be careful what I say here. But the way we have become gerrymandered in terms of our election processes, that we are basically dividing ourselves so that we elect through the primary system some of the extremes in terms of the individual parties out there. And the system, and then the cost of the amount of money that's spent on elections is just exorbitant, such that people don't have the opportunity to really, you have to be rather rich, or you have to have a lot of support, and then the support comes from people who have various interests, special interest in terms of, so it creates its, I think we create our own problems there. When I was early staffer, I began my career on Capitol Hill, for all practical purposes in 1976 when the Congressional Budget Office was established. And members spent time in Washington. They actually had owned homes or rented homes here, and their families grew up, and senators and congressmen got to know each other, even across the party lines. And that doesn't seem to work today. It seems to be that members fly in on a Monday, have what we call a bed check vote in the House, and then they fly out on Thursday afternoon, and they never get really to know their colleagues across the aisle. And by the way, that's one of the programs that the Bipartisan Policy Center has launched a couple of years ago, which we bring a Republican and a Democrat from different parts of the country, and one spends a weekend at one district, and the next weekend or farther on at the other, and they get to know each other much better. And this personal thing just doesn't exist anymore. It's all, You're a Republican, you're a Democrat, or you're on the right, you're on the left, but there's no coming together there. And then finally, I don't mean, Jeff, to in any way light of the importance of the First Amendment, but I worry about some of our social networks that we have and some of the various platforms out there that have a ability to stir up and stimulate whether it's truthful or not. And I think that the growth of the social networks has also created some of the difficulties we have today. I wish I had an answer to you as to how to correct all this, but at least that's my assessment of why we're having such difficulty today finding common ground between Republicans and Democrats.
Let's talk the big issues in front of us now.
Right.
A whole lot of red ink is flowing out of Washington. Some drastic means are being taken, and some say we can't afford not to take these means. What are your thoughts toward DOGE and this downsizing of government?
Well, first of all, nobody can take a Republican or Democrat can take a position that where there is waste, where there is fraud, where there is misuse of the taxpayers' dollars, we all agree that we should eliminate that from the system. Doge and Mr. Musk have made some rather big moves that are, from my perspective, helpful in some ways. When the executive order was established that brought about Doge on the first or second day of the president in office, it was a focus on technology. Obviously, Mr. Musk and at that time, Mr. Ramaswamy and others, they were big businessmen who understood the use of technology. And quite frankly, I think the federal government could use a real hand up help in the technology area. Computer systems, some of the computer systems over at the IRS are still operating under Fortran 4. That's a way out of date computer system, as I understand. And so I was all supportive of the initial Doge executive order that said, listen, let's improve our systems for determining eligibility for benefits or to determining how to make our government more efficient. And so that's all positive. I think the unfortunate situation is that Doge became more of a quickly, let's eliminate programs that the president and Mr. Musk maybe also ideologically did not like. So whether you supported USAID or not, I'm sure there are ways to improve the efficiency of USAID. But using a chainsaw approach, as he's demonstrated at one of his conferences, to approach that, I think it has created a lot of consternation. Let's be clear that in during the Reagan administration, which we went through the same situation of trying to improve the efficiency effectiveness, the federal civilian workforce was about 2 million. Where are we today? 2 million. We have grown in certain areas, such as the Veterans Administration. There's a reason why we've grown in the Veterans Administration, mm-hmm. not only the aging situation, but also the simple fact that, unfortunately, those young men who come back from those wars, whether Vietnam now, particularly my generation, if they didn't come back in a body bag, unfortunately, they came back with lost limbs. And that's the Veterans Administration. And so it has grown, no question about it. Was that good? I think so. But yes, are there inefficiencies? Maybe. So let's find them. But you do this through a more of a process than just simply coming in and sending out memorandums and saying we're going to eliminate 20% of the workforce. Today we spend about 7% of all federal spending is on salaries and expenses. 7%. And if you were to reduce that, cut it down by 20%, you'd save less than $100 million. There's savings there, but that's not what's driving, when I get back to my budget side, that's not what's driving spending in this country. What's driving spending is the third rails of politics. Let's be clear. It's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Net interest on the public debt, the only way you can control that is reduce interest rates. And if you add up those items, you're basically 75% of federal spending you can put on one hand, and that's Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, and paying interest on the public debt, and the thing that's in the Constitution are national security expenditures.
There have been those who criticized Doge, saying that essential services to those in need were being cut to pay for tax cuts.
Yep.
Clearly, if Congress doesn't act, the tax bill will go up for a lot of people. What pressure is this country facing, and can you Doge your way to resolving those tax issues?
Well, I will be the first one to admit that if there are savings to be achieved in Doge, there is a procedure. Let me go first there, and then we'll go back to the tax side. Literally 50 years ago, about 50 years ago, quite frankly, when I got on this merry-go-round, we passed something called the Congressional Budget Impoundment Control Act. And it grew out of another crisis we had at the time with another president. And it wasn't Watergate, but President Nixon was impounding monies under Article 1 of the Constitution, where the Congress had authorized programs and Congress had appropriated the money for those particular programs. President signed both the authorizations. He signed a big appropriation bills, but then he did something which created later, the raison d'etre, if you like, for the Congressional Budget Pound Crime. He said, I'm not going to spend the money that I, in fact, have signed for. I'm going to impound it. Congress looked around and said, oh my gosh. And the other point that President Nixon, to his credit, said, listen, you crazy people up there on the Hill, you don't have a system. Sometimes you like to spend money in an even number year or cut taxes in an even number. You don't have a system that looks at the total fiscal picture. Only I, and in fact, I think the terms of Schlesinger's book was imperial presidency, sounds familiar, said, only I can see this. And so Congress, to their embarrassment, said, he's right, we don't have a system. And out of that came the Congressional Budget Impoundment Control Act, one of the last pieces of legislation that President Nixon signed in July of 1974. And that set up a process. And the process is, Mr. President, you want to not spend this money that Congress has authorized and appropriated. You have every right not to spend the money, but there's a process. You have to submit to Congress what we call a rescission bill, and we agree with you. And in fact, interestingly enough, it's fast tracked. Simple majority can't get filibustered. There is a way. So I am of the mindset that if there are real savings to be achieved through the DOGE process that they're going through, if they've moved off improving our computer systems, and if they want to look at individual programs, fine, Mr. President, submit a rescission to Congress, and Congress will agree or disagree with you on it. Right now, the crisis that we seem to be getting ourselves into is that there is a sense that the administration doesn't believe the Congressional Budget Impoundment Control Act is constitutional. And as a consequence, this is a test. I think the president and the executive branch is testing a lot of laws that we have today as to their constitutionality. And so that's where we are. We don't, again, I say, I'm fine, Mr. President. You want to not spend money? There's a process. Follow the process that came out of the 1974 Act.
Rand Paul from Kentucky, Senator, said the money that has been saved should go through a rescission.
Yes.
That way it is claimed.
That's exactly what, to his credit, Senator Paul is doing the right thing by making that argument, because I agree with him on it. And
Now let's talk about taxes. Because if we don't do anything, if Capitol Hill doesn't do anything on taxes, the tax coffers are going to go up in a hurry.
Yeah, this is a dilemma. You take those major provisions in the tax bill that expire, whether it's the individual rates, or whether it's bonus depreciation, whether it's the estate tax, or it's a 199A. Those provisions really impact the ag sector particularly, since we're talking about the ag network here. And so, yes, this would be devastating if those tax cuts don't get extended. And I don't like paying taxes any more than anybody else, but I think there is a price to be paid for the services that government does provide today. So what happens if Congress is now debating how to extend those expiring tax provisions? And the biggest question right now is very simply, which simple extension over a 10-year period, you've heard the numbers, I'm sure, between $4-4.5 trillion, shouldn't we offset those tax cuts by paying for them, or modifying the amount of the tax cuts so that it doesn't add that much more to the federal deficit? And clearly some of the tax cuts will help have an economic benefit to them. But tax cuts, in my experience over many years at the budget, they don't all pay for themselves. They are with economic growth. So we'll see. But as it stands right now, the debate is, can we get this tax bill done quickly, before all the provisions expire into this year? And at this moment, back to Jeff, the top of our conversation here, partisanship is filling in. How do you pay for them? You pay for tax cuts by reducing spending in other areas, and maybe some of it's in DOGE, but some of the programs that the president has taken off of the table, and I realize how controversial what I'm about to say is, Social Security, mm-hmm. Medicare, even now the president's saying Medicaid's off the table, farm price supports. These are big programs that that a lot of people depend upon, particularly the low-income individuals and Medicaid. And if you've taken them off the table, it's pretty darn hard to find $4.5 trillion in offsets, even with DOGE, to be honest with you.
These are numbers that my mind doesn't wrap around
right.
when we get to trillion. But if you're talking about $4 to $4.5 trillion in offsets for taxes, then we add this farm bill that we've desperately needed for some time that I'm told will get close to $1.5 trillion. Now you're at $5.5 to $6 trillion, and you're facing a debt ceiling that's going to come up sometime in 25.
Very soon. One of the areas that the Bipartisan Policy Center has distinguished ourselves in is what we call the X date. When do we actually hit that date when we default? And the federal government has never, never defaulted. We've had potential government shutdown. That's different. A default says that we can't honor our bonds and debt that we have outstanding. That is very dangerous. The BPC will come out with a range. Depends a lot upon the tax filings on April the 15th when revenues come in. But I think most people expect that we'll hit this debt limit sometime, maybe late spring, early summer. I don't know. We'll see what the numbers as we're, as staff are putting them together as we speak. And we'll see. But the debt limit is very, to me, is something that really we do not want to default. The credit of the United States is sacrosanct. As I mentioned earlier to somebody, we are the best-looking horse in the glue factory. But if we default, a lot of those foreign dollars may not come here to our by our debt, but go other places. And when that happens, you still have to fund the government, and you still have to meet your other requirements. And what that means is you'll have to increase the what you pay for it, so interest rates will go up.
We're already squeezed for what we're able to provide from government because of the size of the debt and paying the interest on the debt. And
yep.
if we have to start paying higher interest
yep.
to attract those foreign dollars, now we're even in a worse shape. And if we've thought about the pain of cutting now, what will be the pain of cutting then?
Well, it will be dramatic. Then we are talking about the across-the-board reductions in just about everything. And the debt is something like $36 trillion and increasing. We're at well over 100% of our GDP now goes there. I'm not running for office, so I can say this. I think members need to be a little bit more transparent with the American public as to why we have this debt situation or deficit situation. And they have to recognize that can be solved by just cutting USAID, which makes up 1% of the federal budget. It can't be just by eliminating or cutting back on the number of civil servants. You have to take some really tough decisions. And I'm not talking about cutting. I'm talking about slowing the rate of growth. And that means modification to these important programs so that people continue to receive their benefits going forward. You have to realize that in 2033, I hope I got my date right, the Social Security Trust Fund is exhausted. It doesn't have any more money. And at that point, there will be cuts of 20% unless we modify that program. The people will still get Social Security benefits, but it will be at a lower rate, it's predicated upon the payroll taxes coming. It's pay in, pay out at that point. Right now, we're operating with a trust fund surplus, but that trust fund will exhaust. There will be pain coming there.
The weakness that comes toward the U.S. economy adds fuel to the fire for those that would like to exchange the U.S. dollar for international trade, and that is a completely different bailiwick.
Oh, I am very, very worried. When you start lowering that that dollar, you're going to see some real problems in our trade situations, in our international settings around the world, and I am that's why I think there is a reason why we need to really do focus on our economic situation that we have today, mainly for my children, grandchildren, in the future, because that we're going to leave them a tremendous amount of debt, which means that they're going to have to be paying a lot of interest, and the lower standard of living would be forthcoming.
Well, we could kick dust for a little while longer with all the issues that are facing, but let me try to bring this to a summary with your thought, if we can. A debt ceiling is coming up. A farm bill needs to be done. Taxes are in place, and there's discussion of budget reconciliation. Read the tea leaves up on the hill, and let's talk about a process. What comes first? Can they even get to taxes this year?
Well, the process is we're really at step two, 10-step process. Because of the very, very narrow margins that exist both in the House and in the Senate, and because of the great deliberative body called the United States Senate that requires 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, Congress has leaned on this budget process to get around the filibuster in the Senate. By that, they get around it by, first of all, passing a budget blueprint that lays out what they want to do in terms of spend, tax cuts, savings, going forward. Passing a budget resolution. House has done it. Senate has done it. We got to find a compromise between the House. We do not have that today. And there's a big difference between the House and Senate. But I assume that before Memorial Day, that Congress will find a way to bring that together. My friend Chuck Connors has indicated he thinks there'll be one bill. When the Senate started, it thought we'd just have one big beautiful bill. We would do a budget resolution for the current fiscal year, 25, and then later on we could do a budget resolution for 26, and that would then take the taxes. But it seems to be we're coming together with doing one bill, and that's where the House and Senate will compromise here in a budget resolution. Once they get the budget resolution conference agreement, this doesn't go to the president for his signature. This is guides the House and Senate on the actions that they take down in terms of their policies. Then there will be this, what we call a reconciliation instruction in that budget resolution, telling committees of jurisdiction to make changes of laws within their jurisdiction to achieve a particular dollar outcome. Tax cuts, maybe, spending cuts in Medicare, maybe, or Medicaid, not Medicare probably right now, but Medicaid, maybe even in the farm programs, the SNAP program. But anyway, they'll give the committees instructions. There are 11 committees right now in the House and Senate that will likely be instructed. They will then go to work to put together the legislation to achieve that blueprint. And then they'll have to come again, compromise, work between the House and Senate, put that together in a final bill that then it gets sent to the president. And that bill would not be subject to a filibuster. That is going to take time. And what's going to happen is we're going to hit the debt limit before we're able to put together that kind of a bill. So I personally believe that you're going to see a lot of leverage for one party or the other party here, I guess, surrounds this debt limit, because we do not want to default. And that, as I say, I think that's going to come a lot faster than getting a tax bill done in the Congress or any reconciliation bill. I tend to be a pessimist in a lot of timing, but I do think that we'll get there eventually. But it may require some extensions of the current tax law into maybe 25, maybe as far into 26. I don't know, but into 26, realizing that that's a another election year, and then we're right back to the politics in an election year.
Well, Bill Hoagland, we want to thank you for your experience, your time spent in serving the country, and then also being with us here today.
It was a pleasure, Jeff.
This is Open Mic. And on Open Mic, our guest has the last word.
Oh, well, thank you, Jeff. And this has been a pleasure. As I mentioned, I grew up on a farm in Indiana. My background is in food and nutrition. I think it's such a critical element of our economy. And I think the most important thing I would like to see is that agriculture continues to be a major driver of this economy, which it is. And I also would like to see improvements in our system of our politics. I am nervous, and I am not, even though I work for Republicans for all these years, I'm not as comfortable with where we are today as it was when I was working with, say, Senator Dole or Senator Baker or Senator Domenici on the Republican side. I think there was a different type of member who is willing to do what I think is important, which is to that old Madisonian thing I mentioned, compromise. And we've got to get back to the point that recognize that compromise is the only way to govern in a country as big and diverse as the United States.
Our thanks to Bill Hoagland, Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. America's sweetest industry creates jobs and provides a sustainably produced food ingredient. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.